Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If your typical American lifestyle suddenly became impossible to sustain, how would you cope? Would your family be able to adjust to leaner times and harder work? My guest today knows exactly how she would deal with any number of crises, from economic depression to fuel shortages to the ravages of advanced climate change, because she is already living as if she had to. Sharon Astick is a writer, teacher, and subsistence farmer. Convinced by the nightmare scenarios presented in books like The Long Emergency that as global resources are strained to the breaking point, she and her husband and their four children are committed to living closer to nature and farther from the grid than most of us can imagine. She writes about the joys and the hardships of her decision and shares ideas for those who would like to reduce their own consumption in her new book. It's called Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Homefront. Sharon, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
You write that we are, quote, on the brink of a crisis that will change our world utterly, make your family poorer and more vulnerable, and transform the lives of ordinary people into something unrecognizable, end quote. What worries you?
Well, a whole lot of things. I mean, some of this, you know, when I started to write the book, I started talking about things that might happen in the future. And, of course, now that it's published, you know, it's not really hard for us to start thinking about ways that we might get poorer if we're watching, you know, the markets lost $1.2 trillion last week. And that stuff eventually works its way down to ordinary people when people lose their jobs and things. Certainly I'm concerned about things like climate change, which seems to be impacting the number of natural disasters we're facing, the floods in the Midwest, the hurricanes in Texas and Louisiana this year. And I'm concerned with our ability to afford to meet basic needs. We're at a point where one out of every 11 Americans needs food stamps to make the money meet the end of the month, where people in the northern parts of the country where I live are, frankly, in a bit of a panic about how they're going to afford to heat their houses this winter, where gas prices and shortages are an increasing reality. And all these things have a good excuse, oh, this is just about this. But it does seem like the pace of sort of bad stuff happening is picking up a bit.
You admit in the book off the top that you are scared by all this and that you wish denial were an option. Do you think that most Americans are, in fact, in denial about the state of the world?
I think to a certain degree. I think that a lot of times when you look at the things coming, it's just too scary to think about the consequences. And one of the things that I think is really important is that we do think about the consequences, because really a lot of what is coming in the future can be mitigated. It can be dealt with. It's a lot less scary if you look at it head on than if you find yourself with sort of things that go bump in the night in the future.
So people will say to you, why start now? So many other people are still living the way they always have. Why make the sacrifice today?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. The first one is that our way of life is hurting other people. And that's sort of the basic ethical issue of our times. I mean, it's really hard to realize that we in the Western world, when we do very, very ordinary things like, you know, making dinner or going shopping or going to the store, we really are causing a lot of these problems that not only are we dealing with, but other people are dealing with much more directly. We're causing climate change. Our use of fossil fuels is causing this sort of rapid depletion and rising prices. Our dependency on foreign oil is causing some of our geopolitical situation. Our financial situation is based on financial actions not just taken on Wall Street, but in everyday lives. That we're sort of creating our situations as we're also being victimized by them. So part of this is to try and reduce the amount of harm that we're doing to other people, to ourselves, most of all, probably to our posterity. I mean, most people either have children of their own or children in their family, grandchildren, and they care about their future, and that's what grown-ups are supposed to do. They're supposed to do what you can to make life better for the next generation, and we're risking impoverishing not just ourselves, but the future. So that's maybe the most important reason for me. The other reason is that the reality is that the kind of changes that I think we're going to have to make can be done well or badly. It's really easy, you know, living without electricity is something that you can master when the hurricane comes and you're without electricity for 2 weeks, or it's something you can master beforehand and have it be kind of a minor inconvenience that you don't notice that much. So there's a lot of ways to make this not as scary and not as hard and not as unpleasant simply by thinking ahead.
You write in the book that single people who want to do this might want to consider looking for a like-minded partner. I'm wondering if you and your husband have always seen eye to eye on this.
That's sort of a good question. My husband teaches environmental physics. He's an astronomer. And so he really knew about all of this stuff, for example, about energy depletion, which is news to a lot of people. The physics textbooks that he was working with talked about the imminence of oil depletion. However, knowing it on that level and knowing it in a, oh, and we actually might have to change our lives level is somewhat different. And my husband's not that enthusiastic about change. So, he often says, we've been together now 12 years, and he often says, well, probably we might be engaged by now if you left it to me. So, of course, we're married. We have four kids. And I always say, if you'd realized that 10 years from now you'd be living on a farm with your four kids and milking goats every morning, you'd have run screaming into the night. And that's probably pretty much true. But so we generally agree on principle, but I'm definitely the sort of pushy one who says, and now we should do this. And my husband's like, honey, runaway freight train.
Yeah, does it feel like a runaway freight train in the sense that was it a sort of gradual change for you, or did your commitment did you take it on overnight?
No, thank God. I didn't overnight. And I think it's one of those things that people do in steps. I mean, we certainly, when we were living in the city in Boston, we certainly tried to reduce our use of energy. And then we moved out to the country for a host of reasons. And we began to take on more projects and different projects and things like that. And we've made some pretty radical changes fairly rapidly, but the whole thing of our lives, whatever you want to call it, that's been sort of a project over about 7 or 8 years.
How different does your life look to someone driving by your house or someone who stops over for coffee than their own home might look?
Not very at all, actually. There are some physical features of our home that are different. During the winter, I cook on a wood cook stove, but then a lot of people out where I live have wood heat, so this is just a slightly funny-looking wood cook stove. You'd come to my house, and in the summer, I might get food out of the fridge, but we don't actually plug our fridge in. We use our fridge. We have a freezer because we sell poultry off of our farm, so what I do is I put ice packs and frozen bottles of water in the freezer each day, freeze them, and then rotate them once every day and use the fridge as an icebox, which cuts our electricity use pretty dramatically. But you can't see that unless you happen to notice, oh, I never did hear the fridge cycle on, but we're so used to that we don't notice it. There are a couple other differences. One of the big ones is that we have a very small car. It's a Ford Taurus, and because it has a bench front seat, we can now put all six of us in this car, and we look kind of like clowns climbing out of the little tiny car when we get out of it. It's not especially comfortable, but it's a lot cheaper than maintaining two vehicles, the larger one. And most of the time, there aren't all six of us in the car, and when we have to go long distance, we rent or we take public transportation.
Sharon Astick is my guest. Her new book is called Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Home Front. Let's talk about food. You grow a lot of what your family eats, and then you try to follow what you call the bullseye diet. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. We do grow an increasing amount of our own food. We produce milk from our dairy goats, and we have chickens for eggs, and we do eat them. And we also grow quite a lot of vegetables. And then most of it, what else we get from local sources whenever we can. And the idea of the bullseye diet was, maybe a lot of people have heard of the 100-mile diet. There's been a lot of clubs and development of this idea that you should eat locally. And 100 miles is a nice round number, and it helps sort out, okay, what's really local. And I started thinking about this 100-mile diet idea not too long ago, when I sort of was thinking about, well, could everybody in New York City do the 100-mile diet, or everybody in Tucson or L.A.? And the problem with that is, of course, they can't, because if you live in New York City, for example, your 100-mile circle runs into the 100-mile circle of Philadelphia and Albany and Trenton and Stamford and all these other cities and large areas with lots of population and not a lot of farms. So this question became, okay, how could we adapt the 100-mile diet, which was a great idea, by the way. It was founded by a couple in Canada, and which has done a lot to get people eating locally. But how can we adapt the 100-mile diet in such a way that it acknowledges that most of us aren't going to eat every single thing that we consume locally, but where we can sort of focus in on primarily getting things from as close to home as we can. And we start in our yards and in our houses and on the back porch, you know, where we've got the containers with tomatoes growing. And you work outwards from there to your immediate neighborhood and your town and your sort of bioregion where your food shed comes from, and then outwards.
So you try to make your bullseye basically the biggest element of the circle.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely it, is as locally as possible. And obviously, I can grow a lot more food than somebody living in Houston or Dallas is going downtown is going to be able to grow. And yet, cities in a lot of parts of the world produce a surprising amount of their own food.
You packed up and left Boston to do this, and you recognize that not a lot of people are in a position to do so. But can you talk about what they ought to consider if they're going to choose a region of the country to try and really reduce their consumption? What they should think about when choosing where to live?
Well, one of the things, I mean, quite honestly, I think the most important thing that people are going to choose is where is your family? And by family, I mean not just biological family, but the people who matter most to you in your life. Because quite honestly, I think a lot of us are going to make our decisions based on, you know, being near the people that matter to us. And I think that's probably the right way to figure things out, quite honestly. I mean, we're going to depend on one another, I think, a lot more in a lower energy world. Instead of being able to hire somebody to do something, we're going to need our brother-in-law to come over and help us do this stuff. So that's one major factor. In terms of other issues, my big concerns are food security, water issues, in sort of dry places, finding ways to capture rainwater or to use water efficiently and carefully, making sure that you can grow food where you are, because the reality is as more and more people get priced out of sort of supermarket food, and we're seeing that reality right now, people are going to have to grow some gardens in order to get reasonably priced, nutritious food. I also don't recommend people buy houses that are set right on top of energy resources, because we're going to find a lot of people trying to extract, you know, coal and natural gas and oil from, you know, one last digging experience coming up. So it's a tough place because there's a lot of environmental contamination that goes with that.
And I guess another thing that you had to think about was living in a place you wanted to have chickens and you have goats. Obviously, zoning has to allow for that.
It does. I think zoning is something that can change. There's already sort of a movement, a right to dry movement growing across the United States, whereas a lot of developments have outlawed clotheslines over the years. There's a growing movement that says this is crazy. I mean, the air dries your clothes naturally if you just hang them outside. We've got to start letting people put out clotheslines. And that's true of things like chickens and front lawn gardens and things. That said, however, it's easier to go places where this isn't a problem. At the same time, the places where we most need to grow food, the places where we need chickens the most, the places we need all of these things the most, is the places people already live.
Sharon Astick is my guest. She is a writer, teacher, and subsistence farmer. Her new book is called Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Homefront. We'll be back to our conversation with her in a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Sharon Astick. Her new book is called Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Home Front. It looks at strategies for surviving in a world that is very different from the one we know today, based on economic crises, global climate change, and the end of easily affordable energy. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. You vowed for more than a year to buy almost nothing except food and fuel. Can you talk about what you learned in that time?
Yeah, we were perfect, by the way. The first thing I have to say is that we did make the occasional, we did violate our rules a couple of times. But we did go a whole year living mostly on what we already had or making do with things. And what we discovered was that it wasn't that hard, actually. I mean, there were moments of inconvenience and the occasional moment of, oh, my gosh, I really need this and I don't have it. But it was surprisingly easy, particularly if we were willing to rely on other people, to sort of connect through community with other people, to say, oh, my gosh, I don't necessarily have a suitcase that'll get me to this trip, but I could borrow one from my neighbor. Or, oh, the vacuum cleaner broke. Well, we only use the vacuum cleaner once a week anyway. What if we did borrow it? And, of course, you know, we traded other things that we had and offered them to our neighbors as well. So it was one of those things. The biggest revelation we had was how much shopping is a substitute for relationships in the world.
Wow, that's very interesting. And in fact, you write that the time that you ordinarily would have spent shopping is the time for people who would worry about how much it takes to garden and grow your own food. It's pretty much the same for you.
It really is. I mean, we garden probably on a scale bigger than most people are going to. But even then, we found that we just got an enormous amount of time back by shopping less frequently because it is kind of a big project.
Yeah, and in terms of cutting consumption, one of the things you point out is that it means not having the right product all the time and just dealing with it. And I think that's something that we've forgotten, that a saucepan is a rice maker and the oven is a bread maker.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, I'm as subject to this disease as anybody else, to thinking, okay, how am I going to do this without the right tool? I want to start, you know, people say, I want to start making my own bread. I have to go get a bread maker. And it's, well, wait a minute, let's try it without the bread maker for a few times and see if you can get good at it that way, and then start thinking about whether we need the tool. So that's been one of the sort of fascinating things that we've really pared down for a lot of sort of specialized tools that we had that we discovered didn't save us that much time, or we didn't really mind doing it the other way.
You write that one year you decided that you were going to make all your gifts so everybody got IOUs for Hanukkah.
Yeah, that was... I needed to start a lot earlier than I did.
But I'm wondering how well the people in your life, your friends, your neighbors, your family, really understand what it is that you're trying to do.
Well, it's sort of funny. I think that there's been a gradual transition from Sharon's a complete nutcase to Sharon's a nutcase, but strangely, things seem to be making a certain amount of sense given the chain of events.
Yeah.
So I think that, honestly, the best advertising I've ever done for my ideas is just saying, okay, but we'll actually see what happens, which unfortunately isn't very pleasant, but it does seem to be, things seem to be working more or less the way that, you know, a lot of other people predicted them to be, and that's who I built on. But the other thing is, I do think that it looks strange, particularly the parts of it that look poor. I think we have a lot of cultural pressure to not seem poor, not to show signs of poverty. So things like, okay, we don't buy certain things because they're expensive and also because they're wasteful, it really troubles people. And sometimes I would find people giving us stuff. Oh, you can't buy things, so I'm going to give you this, or I'm going to buy you this. And it was very sweet, but it's like, you know, we're not doing this because we're living in a cardboard box by the railroad station. We're doing this by choice. So,
yeah, you have a big house and land, and you don't really feel like you're sacrificing in terms of your ability to keep your family safe and healthy and those things.
I really don't, and in fact, in some ways, I think my family's probably safer and a little healthier because of what we're doing. We live on what is a comparatively low income by American standards, but because we sort of don't buy this much, because we sort of pick and choose how we spend our money very carefully, because of good luck and some good health and the fact that we have benefits through my husband's job, I don't want to say that this is something that is all done through our perfect behavior, but we've been lucky enough that we are able to live on a fairly small income by American standards, around $40,000.
And you've got four kids.
And four kids. Yeah. And feel pretty comfortable and put some money away and pay out, not really carry much debt and really do okay for the most part.
Sharon Astick is my guest. Her book is called Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Home Front. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find David in the Colony. Hi, David.
Hi. I had a slight comment for your guest.
Okay.
Yes, I'm very much in agreement with everything that you're talking about, except for one thing, and that is the fact that you have four kids. And my question there would be, human population explosion is without question one of the biggest drains on our natural resources, including energy. And how do you reconcile the fact that you have four children with the goals that you're trying to accomplish? And I'll listen off the air.
Thanks for your call. It's something I know that you've given a thought to, Sharon.
Yeah, actually, it's a very good question. I mean, you know, that's sort of the big elephant in the room when I'm talking about environmental issues. And there are a couple answers to this. One of them is that my understanding of the population issue in some ways postdated my pregnancy. So it's, you know, and when the caller asked how I reconcile it with the fact that I have four children, well, I had three children in a pregnancy before I really fully grasped what this issue was. So there wasn't a whole lot I could do about it. And like everybody else, I come to environmental issues with a fairly imperfect past. You know, I used to fly around on airplanes and travel and do things that, you know, burned a lot of energy and weren't necessarily necessary. And so part of this is when people come to this sort of environmental consciousness, they're not perfect. I'm not perfect. Other people aren't perfect. And this is a reality. You start from where you are, and it's still better, I think, that I'm doing this stuff than that I be driving around in an SUV with the windows open and the air conditioning on with my four kids. So there's that. The other issue is that population is a huge issue, but it's dwarfed in many ways, particularly in this part of the world, by consumption. The average American uses 30 times the resources of the average Kenyan. The average Kenyan has four kids, and we talk a lot about the population explosion in the world, but most of the people who have most of the children in the world don't use that much energy. They don't use that many resources. They're not the driving force of the problem in our world. I mean, despite the fact that the average Kenyan might have four or five kids, their kid is going to use one-sixth the resources of all of their kids together are going to use one-sixth the resources of one American kid.
Now, so, I'm going to stop you for a second because many people will argue, well, by most Western standards, we don't think those kids in Kenya have enough provisions and resources to keep them safe.
That's true. It absolutely is true. There is a happy medium in there, and that's really important. My suggestion is not that we should all be Kenyans. It's that when we talk here in the West about population, we have to be really careful how we talk about population because a lot of times we end up talking about the poor world, who are really not the people doing most of the contribution to global warming. For example, if we took all of the people on the planet, more than half of them who earn less than $2 a day, and removed them, we'd still probably hit all the climate tipping points around the same time because they simply don't contribute that much to emissions. Again, the claim is not let's all live on $2 a day. It's that the biggest problems in the world at this point are coming from overconsumption, not population. This is not an excuse for having four kids. On the other hand, you know, several of my children were conceived while using multiple forms of birth control, some of which weren't supposed to ever fail. I don't want to discuss this on the radio, frankly, but, you know, it's one of those things that I also am the face of the reality that birth control is something that works great over a huge statistical population, but doesn't necessarily is going to have some statistical variance, and we're going to have to deal with those statistical variance ourselves in the real world. And I can reduce my usage of energy to the point that my four kids are going to use resources, fewer resources than one American child. And again, that's not an argument for everybody do as I do. I'm not suggesting that mine is the ideal model. But what I'm saying is that we can reduce our consumption dramatically, much more rapidly than we can reduce our population.
Well, let's assume that we have covered the population issue for the basis of this conversation. And I want to talk about kids in a different way. There's a very funny section of the book where you talk about sort of preparing for winter and you're putting up vegetables and you're putting up corn and trying to get this done. And you said friends will come over and say, how do you do it? And you talk about, you know, the shorthand version that you tell, I've just canned 200 ears of corn. Doesn't include you saying 200 times, stop touching that, go away, I'm busy. You know, how do you kind of, a lot of people can imagine living a lifestyle with four children and not relying on all the technology and power and consumer goods that we've become accustomed to.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to minimize the fact that, quite honestly, my four children do slow down the pace and probably the quality of a whole lot of the things that I do. I mean, the reality is that I do spend a lot of my life saying, don't touch that, stop that, you know. But at the same time, we've also live a life that allows us to integrate our kids in ways that sort of a more industrialized life doesn't allow us. That is, if my husband and I were both working two full-time, high-powered careers, which it's sort of the logical extension of our level of education probably in most families, we would have a really hard time getting dinner cooked with four kids and picking up kids at daycare and running back and forth and getting all this other stuff. Part of the reason we're able to get this stuff done is because we've really worked hard to adapt our lives so that we're home as much as we can be. I know that's not an option for everybody. We consolidated our housing with my husband's grandparents and shared our house with them until they died, which was partly a strategy to enable us to spend less money and, you know, sharing a house, we could divide the expenses and things together. We've really planned our life as much as we possibly can around as little running around as we can. And while that isn't possible for everybody, it does mean that it makes it possible for us to integrate our kids into what we're doing. So a lot of the things I do to not need money, like grow food or mend my clothes or do things to save money, enable me, are things that I can do with my kids around. I can teach my kids to do them. I can have them playing around while I'm hanging the laundry outside in a way that I couldn't do if I was going to work in an office. So it saves some time.
And I know that they're all relatively young and that one of your sons is disabled, but do they work harder than the average American kid?
I'm guessing the average American kid doesn't do a lot of farm chores, so probably yes. I mean, they certainly have their chores. We don't work them 14 hours a day. We're not in violation of any child labor laws. It's hard for me to answer that. I mean, I think it depends on what you think of as work. I mean, I know a lot of kids who are really, really heavily scheduled and who have lessons and classes and things all the time, where my kids are out playing in the yard and climbing trees. And so, it sort of depends on what you think of as work. They do spend more time helping us cook and helping us clean and helping us milk the goats and things. At the same time, I think they spend less time being shuttled for things and, oh, we got to leave right now because we have to be at this place. So it sort of depends on what you think of his work.
Sharon Astick is my guest. Her book is called Depletion and Abundance. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Let's go to Linda in Grapevine. Hi, Linda.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Sharon, it's really great to hear your thoughts on this. Having grown up on a farm in Central California, so much of what you're talking about is really second nature to me. We grew our own vegetables. My father was an almond farmer. We sold almonds. That was how we made a living. He made a living to support the family. Now that I'm an adult, and I'm not living on a farm, not married to a farmer, living in a suburb of Dallas. And one of the things that we have done, though, is we do try to plant a vegetable garden when we live in our home. We make a lot of choices about, you know, making sure that we turn off lights and really try to make those decisions on a not just day-to-day but moment-to-moment basis. And, you know, even we did a remodel about 3 years ago in the state of California. We made very conscious choices about using Energy Star appliances and just the materials that were used in that remodel. So I just, first of all, want to commend you on the topic of your book. I'm very excited, and I'm probably going to order it as soon as I can from Amazon. But I have a question for you, which you kind of already addressed, about talking and working your children into it, and how do you talk to your children? I have an 8-year-old daughter, and a lot of times the topic of conversation for us is, you know, we could afford to do that, but we're choosing not to because we're being careful about how we spend our money, and we're being careful because, you know, as our parents always said, it doesn't grow on trees, and also how it affects other people in the world. And how do you address those topics with your children? And I'll take my answer offline. Thanks, Linda.
Wow, that's great. I mean, this sounds like a wonderful suburban model because, I mean, the reality isn't everybody's not going to live on a farm, and making good environmentally sound suburban and urban homes is just as important as rural ones. In terms of my kids, we do talk to my kids a lot about sort of the impact of their choices. We sometimes talk about, you know, my kids are pretty young. My oldest son, developmentally speaking, my oldest son is 8, but he's disabled. My oldest son is not quite 7, so we don't lay out all the horrible details of climate change or anything. We want them to be kids. But we do sort of say, look, you know, sometimes we're going to have to make choices to protect other people or to make things better for other people. And we feel like when we buy this or we do this, that we maybe are doing some harm to other people. And one of the goals that we have is not hurting people. So sometimes a lot of what we do is just draw the connection between how this action affects other people in the world, both in negative ways when things hurt people, but also in positive ways. Like when we go to the farmers market and we're supporting local farmers and buying local food, I want my kids to understand that this isn't just buying grapes, it's building a local food economy and helping small farmers expand and showing other potential small farmers, oh, wow, there is a market for this. I could do this.
Yeah, it must be interesting to hear your kids then repeat back some of the things that you have told them.
It is. And actually, one of the things that sometimes comes back to bite us is that they are more enthusiastic than we are. So they're like, oh, we could make our own needles. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that.
Sharon Astig is my guest. Her book is called Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Homefront. We'll take more of your calls and emails after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sharon Astig. She's a writer, a teacher, and a subsistence farmer. Her new book is called Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Homefront. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org. That's where Charlie writes from Highland Village. He says, we have been presented with doomsday scenarios for my entire lifetime. First, it was the atomic bomb. And then the U.S. went off the gold standard, and we were warned to stock food and guns for the coming collapse of the economic system, then the stock market collapse, etc. What makes Miss Astig different, other than that she is scared of everything, and is she leaving out the resourcefulness of the human race to adapt to any situation? What's your response to that?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's a perfectly fair question. You know, I would put the caveat that I don't think I am scared of everything. In fact, actually, I don't think I'm that scared. I worry about certain things. It's certainly when I think about the long-term future of my children, that does scare me. I think climate change and peak oil and the sort of financial situation we're facing right now are somewhat scary. But generally speaking, I think because of the stuff I've done, I feel pretty able to manage the future. But going back to the larger question of why is this different than all other apocalypses, I'm not sure it is. I don't necessarily, let me back up. I don't think that nuclear war obviously didn't happen, but I don't think it was a completely unrealistic threat. I don't think that, for example, hard times have ever been an unrealistic threat. While the United States has had a very unusually prosperous and secure period in their lives, about 75 years of just unusually easy times, including World War II, where we didn't have to face war on our shores. Through most of human history, bad things have happened. It's not so much the end of the world, which I think is an easy way to sort of mischaracterize what I'm talking about, so much as a shift to a poorer time, a less secure time, things when we may not have all the stuff that we want. And I think that that's a reality right now for people who are poor. I mean, and an increasing number of people in the United States are poor and struggling. And I think it's an increasingly common reality for people in the poor world as energy prices have risen and 90 countries are experiencing regular shortages of electricity. So I think it's that the wrong way to think about this is the zombies are coming or the, you know, apocalypse is on its way. So much as we seem to be shifting into a place where we're poorer, where certain things we need are more expensive, where the climate is less stable. And it's only prudent and rational, I think, to be prepared for that. And just for the record, I don't have any big stockpiles of ammo or anything.
You write in the book about there are people who have accused you of glamorizing poverty. And you say it's not so much that as recognizing that living with less doesn't necessarily have to make you less happy.
I think that's it. I mean, I had what for me is actually a useful advantage of having been really, really poor for a while. And the experience of being really poor was strangely, I mean, it was certainly terrifying when you were worried about eviction or you were worried about not having enough food for dinner. That part is really scary. But there are ways to manage poverty. There are ways to deal with having less that don't put you in those circumstances. You know, you can share with other people. I mean, one answer to, okay, I can't afford my house, would be to move more people into it. That's what college students do. One answer to, I can't afford the food I'm used to, is to find less expensive food and to start growing some. And if you can manage the really scary parts of poverty, you find a lot of things that aren't really coming into short supply. The fact that community, friendship, love, sometimes leisure time, happiness, the ability to make things beautiful and good in your life. So I feel like it's a question of, okay, can we meet our basic needs with less and still find time to be happy and do the stuff that matters to us?
You were talking about education, and it's interesting. You and your husband is still working as an academic, and that was what your professional background was as well. And one of the tips in the appendix in the back is that if you need something, hang around on a college campus when the dorms are letting out for the summer, because kids throw so much away that is still really useful.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's astonishing to look into the dumpsters at the end of the semester in colleges. And a lot of times students just can't take it home with them on a plane, but we don't have a really good system of reallocating things. I think those systems are actually being built up in the internet as FreeCycle and Craigslist and things start to expand, but there's still just an enormous amount of waste in our society.
Yeah, and you point out that every time we buy something new, like a piece of furniture or an appliance, we tell the manufacturer, please make one more.
That's exactly it, and sometimes it's make five more because, if it's selling well, maybe it could sell even better. And that, unfortunately, is what's gotten us in this situation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Heidi in Dallas. Hi, Heidi.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You just made a point that I was going to make it. I was going to ask you, Gage, what did you think about all the appliance, you know, being sitting around the whole day? You know, 24 hours a day, not being useful, and you know, whenever they use it, because whenever they use it, it's just wasting water, wasting gas. I mean, electricity for nothing.
You're talking about home appliances.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
We've tried really hard to minimize the use of the things that the caller's talking about, things like. For example, we put our water heater on a timer, which means that our water heater isn't heating our water in the middle of the night when we're asleep anyway. And it does use less oil in our case. A lot of people have electricity or natural gas. And we've also gone out of our way to eliminate phantom loads, which are any appliance that you have that has one of those, has a clock on it or has a little light on that all the time. Those are phantom loads, and they're pulling some electricity. And phantom loads can really use up to about a quarter of the energy, electricity, that your house uses. So eliminating those kinds of things, just unplugging the VCR, makes a surprisingly large difference.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Catherine in Dallas. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, this is Catherine. Thanks for taking my call. I enjoy listening to this program. I guess I enjoy really how the author described, you know, how she tries to raise the awareness of her children by educating them and also by explaining the connectors of, you know, what our actions as a human beings cause in the world. And I think, you know, what lifestyles can cause in a greater scale. My question is, growing up and being educated in Switzerland, that is part of our educational system. Not that our parents teach us that as well, but as an example, I was a part of a mandatory cooking class, and the cooking class was not just created so we learn cooking, but also economical buying of foods, composting foods, and, for example, being aware of garbage that, you know, packages create, etc. So I'm wondering, how much influence do you think will in the future be maybe created in this regard as well through the school system? It's nice as a parent, you obviously reach your 4 children, but a teacher might be able to reach 20 or more children at once.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
That's a great point. I mean, and ecological education is something that's going to be really, really important coming into this thing. And we really used to have those kinds of structures. It's one of those things that's sort of easy to laugh at now, but home economics classes, which probably all of us had in like 6th or 7th grade somewhere and then didn't pay any attention to again for the rest of our lives, came out of sort of older periods of hard times where it was really important people understand what kind of food they were buying or where people understand how to fix things to sort of enable women, and it usually was women, but it really should be men and women since, you know, there's no reason to gender these activities, to enable people to learn how to connect their sort of domestic activities with sort of these larger economic and social activities. And I think we're going to need to reinvent home economics in a lot of ways and maybe take some of the stigma off of this concept that, wow, consumer issues really are important. And, oh, wait, we're not just learning to sew because it's some arcane skill, but because we might actually have to fix our pants someday.
You have plans to homeschool your 3 younger children. Your older son is in a private school right now. Do you think it would be more difficult to sustain this with your kids if they were sort of surrounded by other children in a public school setting who live a very sort of standard American life?
Well, I think so, although I don't actually keep them chained in the basement. And my kids do go to Hebrew school. They go to, you know, a whole bunch of programs. They have friends in the neighborhood who go to public school. So, yes, I think that it would be harder if we didn't homeschool. But that's not the primary reason we homeschool 2 of my sons. It's part of it is to save energy. The bus would be coming down our road when it didn't have to every day. But also, I think part of the reason that we homeschool is also that it does give us a chance to integrate this sort of ecological factor into education. And we do also try when we can to take it out to our Hebrew school, to the public schools, to as many sources as we can, because I do think that there's an enormous amount of training of people that is needed to help us learn to eat new foods and learn to shop differently and learn to live differently.
You, by the way, we talked about the local diet. You eat almost exclusively things that are in season regionally. And so you talked about, you know, when strawberries come in season, you eat them like mad for a month, and then that's it for a year.
It is, actually. And the funny thing is, we don't mind it. You'd think, oh, my gosh, I can't have strawberries except in June and early July. Except that the great thing about this is, first of all, you eat them, you know, the first time you eat them, this is, oh, my God, I haven't had a strawberry in a year. And it's a wonderful, wonderful pleasure. And then, of course, you have this glut of strawberries. And, you know, there's nothing, you know, you have to eat strawberries all the time because you have so many of them. And by the end of it, I'm ready to be done with strawberries and move on to cherries and peaches and grapes and apples and all that other good stuff. And every time of year really has its own special pleasures and things that we're looking forward to.
Are there things that you really miss that you've decided you need to deny yourself because this is something you've committed to?
There are a couple of things. If the world were how I would like it to be, I think probably we would have a slightly bigger car. It gets a little tight after a while. there are some things. I try not to travel too much. I get invited sometimes to speak in really cool places, and I'd like to go there. And back when I was younger, I used to do a lot of international travel, and it's not that I won't go anywhere, but I do sort of try to realize that there's an impact to my going places and sort of pick and choose very carefully. So there are things that I do. Overwhelmingly, I don't feel like I'm losing any sleep over them because so many of the other things in my life really are so pleasurable and making me so happy.
We have time for one more quick call, and that is Peter in Dallas. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I have a question today concerning the new use of technology like solar cells and lights and, you know, efficiency appliances and that kind of thing. I know that you try to spend less and kind of use the simple ideas, but have you embraced any of this new technology in your home and your life?
Definitely. I mean, we recently replaced our old washing machine with a front-loading washer, and I have to say, like, if it were possible to have a romantic relationship with an appliance, I definitely was very happy with this. We do try to be selective about how we use new technologies, but certainly if we're going to use an electric appliance, it makes sense to get the most efficient one, the one that's going to last the longest, that's going to cause the least damage to the environment that's possible. I mean, we do not live, we're not Amish. We do use computers and, you know, we have a TV and we use appliances. We use probably fewer than the average household, but when we do use them, the advances in technology have really sometimes made big differences. I mean, my front loader uses half the water and detergent that the old washing machine used to use.
What do you gain from all this, Sharon, that other people don't recognize until they've tried it?
Well, there are three big gains. The first one is sort of the easiest one to talk about is money. Again, we talked about our family lives on a comparatively low income. And a lot of the choices we made, not only are they the right thing to do for environmental reasons, but they have allowed us to live without debt. I don't have to worry about bill collectors coming to call. I don't have to worry about being overextended. And a pretty comfortable life that we probably couldn't have otherwise. The second thing is time. Some of this stuff is more work when you start doing it, but the payoff is that as you need less stuff, sometimes you can work fewer hours, or you can spend more time doing things you like and less time doing things you don't like, or more time doing things with your family than far away. And the third one is there's a joy and a satisfaction to making things with your own hands, to watching your kids take pride in having produced their first pumpkin. There's a comfort in knowing that my food is safe and I know what's in it. There's that, all these good things that really come, that sort of add up to happiness, I think, for us.
Sharon Astick's book is called Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Home Front. Sharon, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.